I'm very pleased to welcome back to View from the Roundhouse Professor Martin Drum from Notre Dame University. Welcome back, Martin.
It's fabulous to be here. Always enjoy summers in Perth. It's fantastic.
Well, it's not summer in Israel and Gaza. It's probably not snowing either, but it is possibly ceasefire time. Martin, something we're hoping we'll see a lot of during 2025, if not the resolution of a lot of wars on various fronts around the globe. We've talked a lot about Gaza, we've talked a lot about Ukraine. There are terrible things happening in Sudan and other parts of Africa. We'll come back to those in later broadcasts. Martin, I'm looking at the BBC website. A story posted just 2 hours ago carries the heading Israel delays vote to approve Gaza ceasefire deal. It quotes, as does the New York Times, US Secretary of State Antony Blinken, of saying it was a loose end being tied up. He was confident the ceasefire would still begin on Sunday as planned. They're 6 hours behind us in Gaza and Israel, which means it's getting on to 3 o'clock in the morning Friday. We're coming up to 9 o'clock in the morning here. What do you think's going to happen, Martin?
I'm not surprised by what we've seen in Israel, and I don't think it'll be an impediment to them signing the deal. So I think the ceasefire will go ahead. Just a short recap. The ceasefire requires Hamas and its affiliates to hand back 33 hostages. Requires Israel to release around about 1,000 Palestinian prisoners. Requires a cessation of all hostilities and requires a withdrawal from Israel over a period of time. A ceasefire is just that. It's the stop of the ceasing of firing. It's not actually a permanent peace deal. It's still a massive step forward for what's been a brutal and awful conflict. It's cost many, many lives and caused a lot of division here in Australia as well, Michael, that we've covered from time to time. So that's a really welcome development. The far right in Netanyahu's government, and part of the challenge has always been that Netanyahu has had far right members in his coalition in government. So he's always felt the need to, cater for them, pander to them, offer concessions to them. He's now got a big enough coalition so he doesn't actually need them. So if the far right, some members of the far right resign from his cabinet and his government, it'll still stay afloat. And for their supporters, any negotiation, any peace deal with Hamas and the other armed factions in Palestine is unacceptable. So I don't think they'll accept it. And their grandstanding after the peace deal was announced doesn't surprise me at all. I suspect that's probably been factored in within Israel when they've negotiated this. So I would certainly hope that the peace deal still goes ahead. It's a procedural thing. So the negotiators have promised that Israel will sign it, but it does need formal cabinet sign-off to do so. So that's, we're told, going to happen on Monday. That's a frustrating delay, but it may not be scuttle the whole thing. I think everyone outside those sort of extreme camps would like to see peace, you would have hoped, Michael. Some people who sort of would like to keep on fighting endlessly, but the vast majority of people would like to see peace and like to see aid go into that area. And so the civilians have been caught up in this awful conflict to get some assistance and eventually see a longer-term peace deal. I think the longer-term peace deal is the really hard bit. I wouldn't be surprised if the ceasefire comes into effect. The challenge is how long it lasts and then what comes next, Michael. I think that's what we're all concerned about.
Well, Martin, that then brings into the play the actual administration and presidency of Donald Trump. He gets inaugurated on the 20th. I was a very slow learner when it came to realizing there's probably some connection between the 20th of January and the inauguration and the sudden closing of a deal, or very close to the closing of a deal for a ceasefire. Many of our listeners will have seen Joe Biden walking away from the microphone and then turning back to answer a question about Donald Trump's involvement, and he asked whether the question was a joke. But you can't discount the Trump factor in all of this, can you? In fact, it's not to be unremarked that Netanyahu first talked about thanking Trump before he got to thanking Biden in relation to the ceasefire.
Yes, I think that the advent of the Trump presidency is critical here. You've got to remember, Biden promised pretty much exactly the same deal, or proposed, I should say, pretty much the same deal in May last year. So that's what, 7 or 8 months ago. And Trump coming in, it's clearly the X factor and the different point. Netanyahu and Trump get along well, much better, I think, than Netanyahu and Biden. And I think Trump would like this problem to go away. It's not so much perhaps a concern for civilian casualties or aid into Gaza, etc. It's a problem he'd rather not have at the advent of his presidency. So he's done two things. He's leaned on Netanyahu, and I think that's had an impact. And on the other side, he's basically told Hamas that there's hell to pay if they don't come to the table. So, he'll have no qualms in giving Israel a free hand if Hamas doesn't do a deal with them. So he's used that leverage. That's all well and good. I welcome the peace deal, Michael, as the vast majority of us will. I think the question is, and it's a really positive development. The question is, what happens after the 42 days of phase one, provided it actually holds for 7 weeks, for 6 weeks? What happens next? And there's a plan, there's a phase two and a phase three. But then they involve serious discussions around the future of Gaza. And who's going to lead those discussions? Are both parties seriously committed to it? Are they going to compromise in a way that achieves lasting peace?
Martin, what effect, if any, given we've seen a lot of Donald Trump and heard him on a lot of issues over the last number of years, do these facts, do you think, have on him when read out by his soon-to-be new Secretary of State? After the attack on Israel on the 7th of October to 2023, about 1,200 people were killed and 251 others were taken hostage. But then, according to the Gaza Hamas-run health ministry, more than 46,788 people have been killed in Gaza since then, and many, or at least most of Gaza's 2.3 million population have been displaced. There's widespread destruction, severe food shortages, fuel, medicine, shelter, and aid agencies still can't get in, and that's part of the ceasefire deal. Does that have any impact on a president like Trump?
It's not so much that Trump has shown particular focus on Palestinian casualties. It's just that he knows that it will become an international issue for the US. I think it's probably more that. Trump likes, if you remember, go right back to the first presidency of Trump. Trump sees himself as a deal maker. That's why he sat down with Kim Jong-un, and that didn't go very far. It didn't have a lot of success, but he sees himself as someone that can cut deals. And his first book was The Art of the Deal, Michael. So I think he likes to see himself as being able to cut a deal when other people can't. And in the United States, there is deep discomfort over the extent of Palestinian casualties here. There's also deep discomfort about anti-Semitism in the United States. So there's a lot of prevailing forces within the United States that would like to see this problem go away and a peace deal implemented. So it's more around that domestic politics, I think, Michael, that it comes down to for Trump.
Well, his envoy has been there. He'll have a new Secretary of State, as I intimated, coming in soon. Do you think that there's a side deal or two that have been proposed or agreed between the Trump incoming administration and Netanyahu and the existing Israeli government. I mean, immediately comes to mind, to my mind, that they might have talked about the right of Israel to move into the occupied territory and rename them Israel, something that I see has been mentioned in some of the North American reviews of what's happening.
I think that would probably be a step too far for a range of people that Trump has courted previously in the Middle East. And Trump has had a fairly good relationship for Saudi Arabia, with Saudi Arabia and a few other actors there. I don't think they would countenance a straight occupation like that. And if you recall, one of the things that Trump was seeking was normalizing relations between some of those Arab states and Israel. So I think there's a couple of things probably on the table. Obviously, immunity from any crimes that may have been committed during that conflict would be something Trump would be guaranteeing. I don't think he has a particular warmth towards multilateral global processes, such as the ICC and the like. So he would be guaranteeing Netanyahu immunity there. There would be money and forms of support that would be guaranteed as part of it. So I expect that those sorts of things are on the table. I'm not sure it could probably get away with guaranteeing a full-scale occupation of Gaza.
Martin, the far-right members of the Netanyahu cabinet are threatening to walk out. That would probably bring the government straight down. Netanyahu, by all accounts, for various reasons, is and hasn't been for some time terribly popular. Do you have any guesses about what might happen on that front?
Well, he has been able to add one more moderate partner to his coalition. The numbers I'm told, if the far right walk out of his government, is that he'll hold a 62-58 very narrow buffer in the Knesset and still maintain power. Now he needs to maintain power as long as possible for two reasons. One, that there's significant corruption allegations being leveled against him that he's been able to fend off. And so they'll come back to bite him. And the second thing is, after a war and after you leave government, that's when the accountability often only starts to happen domestically about your actions in government. And there's all sorts of questions around accountability. How did Israel allow that attack to happen in the first place? It was a major security failure, the October the 7th attack. And then, there are many, many hostages which have died in captivity. A lot of them never came back. And of course, there are some people that would like to hold Netanyahu account for his actions in Gaza. So the longer he stays in power, the better for him. And I think that's a major factor behind his thinking.
I wonder what the options are. If it's not Netanyahu, will it be a swing back to a more liberal Israeli government or a swing back to the right?
It's an interesting one, Michael, because those of us that are old enough to remember, prior to about 20 years ago, they had a lot more centrist and even you might call liberal governments. It's been the last two decades where the Knesset's been dominated by Netanyahu, and for most of that period, he's been prime minister. So, that's not the whole history of Israel, but. A lot of that opposition is really divided, Michael. They won power very, very briefly recently and then lost it. They couldn't hold a coalition together. The Labour Party of Israel, which was in power for a long time and produced a number of really significant leaders, some of whom did conducted peace deals, they're a shadow of their former self, that they have very little support these days. So, what you're talking about might require a fairly major shift in electoral politics in Israel.
The thing we sort of keep avoiding, it's too difficult to consider deeply, is the position in Gaza of the Palestinians who live there, the rebuilding Gaza, all of the things I mentioned earlier, just getting food, medical assistance, and the like to them. I mean, and even after this current ceasefire deal was announced as likely to happen, there were strikes on 50 targets in Gaza pretty much immediately, confirmed by the Israel Defense Forces and the Israeli Security Agency. And on the Gaza side, they reported 12 people were killed overnight. I mean, nothing stops till it stops, I suppose. But assume you do get beyond this ceasefire and deal with some immediate humanitarian problems. I mean, how on earth do you, in a sense, recreate that part of Palestine that has been Gaza?
There's enormous challenges there. I mean, you rightly point out that the first challenge is simply to get aid in and to help starving Palestinians and those that have lost everything. That's the most immediate goal. But then there's a really long-term discussion around who actually governs Gaza. Hamas has been in, 17 years. This might be 18 now. In control. That's almost a generation. Michael, that sometimes people talked about the Palestinian Authority. That's the old outfit recent, which used to be run by Yasser Arafat, and is not nowhere near, not very popular in the Gaza Strip now. And the problem, if they came in, they would probably be seen as imposed from outside. Any governance which is seen to be imposed by Israel would be bitterly resented. You would expect after what we've seen. Is there some form of international force, say Arab international force, which might take over the administration running of the company of the country of that strip on a interim basis? That could be feasible, but which country wants to jump in and do that? it's a very risky and fraught task because they'd be inserting themselves in the middle of a really awful situation. Would such a force be capable of maintaining peace and law and order? Would Israel tolerate that on its borders after October the 7th? What assurance, security assurances would they want? Well, there's a and what about the Palestinian people in all of this? What say do they have? They haven't had elections for about 17 years, and half the population's under 17. How do they have a say in their future governance, which is really important too? So all these questions are completely unresolved at the moment.
Martin, we're going to continue to talk about those unresolved questions for some time to come. It's one of the great challenges facing the planet, humans on the planet, the United Nations, or countries that will operate independently of the United Nations for some time to come. We live in a very peaceful democracy by contrast. Probably some people want to debate with us whether or not we live in a democracy, but we are about to go to elections federally, probably in late April, early May. In the state of Western Australia, including here in the seat of Fremantle on the 8th of March, coming up just less than 2 months away. Just looking at what's been going on with the federal election, you could swear there's a campaign already running. We've had the Prime Minister running across the country. We've had the Leader of the Opposition doing the same, seemingly having a launch in Victoria, Martin. Is it some sort of shadow, phony election campaign? They're just sort of warming up their acts. What are they up to?
Well, it's definitely an election year. We know that much. And most pundits are probably suggesting April, May as the federal poll. And certainly Albanese, Dutton, and their various spokespeople and ministers are already well and truly out and about. Albo's been over here. I think Dutton's coming over here shortly. And they're starting to roll out various policies, splash the cash around. Often you wait to post Australia Day, but I don't think either of them have waited that long this time. They're already out and about. I think the case of Anthony Albanese, I think he knows he needs to, change hearts and minds now. He can't wait till post Australia Day. He certainly can't wait till an election's actually called. There's a sense that, the government's been struggling and he really needs to show energy, vigour, and help. change people's minds. So I think he's on to that and has started campaigning vigorously. I think for his part, Peter Dutton wanted to show that he's out and about and off and running, and that's why he had this. It's not really, it wasn't, it was a campaign launch that wasn't a campaign launch, involving a whole range of luminaries and party supporters into a room and then speaking at length. But he didn't actually launch his campaign. Of course, he probably couldn't and wouldn't because we haven't got an election date yet. But he was certainly flying the flag, and you can already see some of the attack lines. So Dutton is painting Albanese as weak and ineffective, and Albanese's painting Dutton as nasty and divisive. So we've talked many times about politics and how negative messages are at the heart and soul of what they're spouting. And there's a couple of good examples for you, Michael, right there.
Well, you have to play to the gallery, I suppose, part of the job. But I've just been acquainted with an expression with an Australian context, Martin. Petrostate. I think Bernard Keane
I
on
saw that from
Crikey
Crikey.
platform
We're
might
the
be
petrostate.
to be praised for his coming up with it. Western Australian petrostate. Well, it makes it hard for the feds to get stuck into a campaign when the election here doesn't happen until the 8th of March. It'd be a bit of a problem for the campaigners, Martin.
It is a real dilemma here. So, like I said, Albanese has been here. Dutton will spend time here. There'll be a lot of campaigning, but we've got a state election in the meantime. So, there is a danger that voters will get confused. And the WAC actually put out a statement suggesting that beware of confusing the voters.
Beware of politicians.
Yeah, that's right. Beware of politicians confusing you as voters. That's a little bit further than what they went, but I think it was quite amusing that they were wary of confusion. The state election certainly is coming first, and we're already seeing plenty of action in the state election. I think there was some analysis in the local paper today about how far and wide the politicians have travelled. Apparently, since I think Roger Cook's already clocked up 7,000, over 7,000 kilometres since the start of the year, Michael. Of course, going up and around the Kimberley and the Pilbara does that. Doesn't take long to rack up those kind of case, but look, that analysis showed that there's on both sides a lot of travel and a lot of electorates being visited. I think dozens literally already this year, and they're putting out their pitch. We saw Law and Order pitches on both sides already this year. I think that will be a particular feature of the opposition's campaign. I think the government was getting in nice and early there. Cost of living, though, is going to be more of a feature, I think, for the returning government. They want to show that they're taking action there. They're throwing around lots of little bits of money. Are you enjoying your free public transport this summer, Michael?
I have, yes.
Because that's one of the things they've been throwing around. I went to the cricket the other day, and I was free. I had free public transport twice because it was summer, and then of course your ticket includes free public transport. So I was wondering if I could get a refund from the government.
Well, before long, the parties, the various groupings, will have their big launches. And I suppose when they do, they'll be bringing together all of these goodies that you've just been talking about, and not announcing too many new things. So far, I have to say, I feel a bit underwhelmed. Maybe it's because the silly season hasn't quite finished. I keep running into people who tell me they're going to work tomorrow, sort of thing. And I guess they're all waiting for people to be tuned into to ordinary, not holiday life.
Yeah, I think that's not a bad assessment. So you're getting various announcements, but you're going to get some bigger, bolder picture announcements, I think, post Australia Day. That applies to federal and state politics. There was a big announcement in housing, I think, coming out of the government. I think that several thousand houses, regional houses to be built, I think. So that's one bigger initiative that they've got onto. But I think there was a number of security measures the Liberals have announced. But I think that there'll be more bigger, bolder promises coming post Australia Day.
Martin, we'll start to draw this to a conclusion, and perhaps we can do so by reference to the very local politics of Fremantle. The seat of Fremantle is up for grabs. The incumbent and long-time member is Simone McGuirk, also a minister in the Cook Labor government. There will be a range of familiar candidates running, or at least parties who are familiar to us. We haven't yet got a name for the Liberal Party. Felicity Townsend is running for the Greens. She previously ran for the federal seat 3 years ago. She's now running for the state seat. But there's a new independent community candidate, a Voices for candidate, Kate Hewlett, who had her launch. Fremantle Shipping News reported on that, and will be reporting on the Felicity Townsend Greens launch, which happens this Thursday night in Fremantle. We await the Simone McGuirk launch, and other people and parties who are launching. It's going to be an interesting campaign for Fremantle, Martin, and between us all, the big, great debate is going to be on at Notre Dame, involving all of these candidates on the 19th of February. What are you making at the moment of the Fremantle campaign?
I think it'll be quite an interesting one. I think having an independent running adds a different element. There have been independents occasionally in the past, but I think in the light of the success of the Till independents at the last federal election, there's a lot more interest in independents these days. There have been a drift from the overall vote away from major parties, which provides opportunities as well. So that's a bit of a different dimension than we've had in previous state election contests. So you've got so far, as you said, Labor MP Simone McGuirk, Felicity Townsend, and Kate Hullett, three very different candidates. I do wonder whether there might be some overlap and cannibalisation between the Greens vote and Kate Hullett's vote as independent, and how that might look. There, that's probably something to watch out for. Because Greens got 18% last time, which is pretty healthy amounts. It's one of the highest votes that they get statewide here. And of course, the Liberals have got 16% last time. It wasn't a great election generally for the Liberals, but the last time round, the Liberal candidate had a lot of energy and vigour. They haven't nominated yet, or they haven't announced a candidate yet. So that will be interesting as well. And then you'll get the usual smattering of other candidates. So I think it'll be a fairly lively contest. And on the 19th of February, I think it'll be a really lively debate.
Well, Martin, we'll talk before then, but I agree it will be a lively debate. Thanks for joining me today, and see you soon.
It's been a pleasure.